Hello, welcome to the Northeast Midwest Institute's briefing on the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, success stories, and the challenges ahead. My name is Matt McKenna. I'm the director of the Great Lakes Washington Program here at the Northeast Midwest Institute. Today we have a very exciting panel of experts that will be able to discuss some of the progress that's been made in the region on Great Lakes restoration. As many of you are well aware, last Congress, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was reauthorized for 5 years at $300 million a year, which obviously is a very big accomplishment for the region and for restoration efforts moving forward. Since its inception in 2010, the GLRI has provided over more than $2 billion in funding for federal restoration projects in the region. GLRI projects focus on cleaning up the toxic Great Lakes areas of concern, the prevention and control of invasive species, the reduction of nutrient runoff that contribute to harmful algal blooms, and the restoration of habitat to protect native species. As you'll hear from the panel today, the current budget atmosphere that is in Washington has created some concerns within the region about the future of the GLRI. The Great Lakes Task Force and both the House and Senate have been very strong supporters of protecting the program in its current form. And for instance, in FY 2017, the omnibus bill included the full $300 million requests while the administration was looking to cut it by $50 million. Obviously, people are well aware that the current administration's budget zeroes out GLRI funding. So as we move forward, we look forward to working with the Congressional Great Lakes Task Forces and other members in preserving the funding. I also wanted to put in a quick note that just Monday, the Great Lakes St. Lawrence Cities Initiative released a short movie highlighting some of the GLRI success stories, and the video actually features several mayors, including the mayor from Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Sheboygan, Wisconsin. So I will send everyone in attendance today a link to that along with other materials I presented today. Hopefully you get a chance to check it out. And I know our time is limited, so I'm going to briefly provide introductions of our panelists, and then I'll let them take it away from there. First, we have Cam Davis, who's currently a vice president at GEI Consultants, where he focuses most of his time on upper Midwest water quality policy, infrastructure, and other water resource efforts. Cam also previously served as a senior advisor to two EPA administrators. We have Chad Lord from the Healing Our Waters Coalition. Chad serves as policy director, and the Healing Our Waters Coalition is made up of more than 145 environmental, conservation, and outdoor recreation organizations that are focused on preserving North America's freshwater resources. We'll also have Whitney Taney from the from Ducks Unlimited. They are one of the largest, or the world's leader in wetlands and waterfowl conservation organizations. And we have Matt Doss from the Great Lakes Commission. He serves as policy director. And the Great Lakes Commission is an interstate compact agency that represents the eight Great Lakes states and includes associate members from both the provinces of Ontario and Quebec. So I'm going to pass it on to Cam to begin the discussion. And
great. Thanks, Matt. And thanks to Michael for hosting today. Thanks to the House and Senate task forces, too, for all that you do to help the Great Lakes. I just wrapped up 8 years with the federal government doing the former administration's liaison work to Capitol Hill, where I had to wear jackets in hot weather all the time. I am not doing that anymore because I'm now in the private sector. So you guys should take off your jackets, too, if you want. Make yourself comfortable. Here's what I want to do today. I considered myself as having worked for all 11 federal departments in the federal government that help coordinate the work under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, or GLRI. Even though my paycheck came from EPA, I considered myself as having worked for DOI, Homeland Security, Ag, the White House Council on Environmental Quality, and others. With that as a little bit of a background, let me give you an overview of the program for those of you who are newer to it. You are going to be hard-pressed to find a more effective, results-oriented program, I think, anywhere, at least serving this part of the country. And it wouldn't happen but for a lot of support from all of you and your offices on the Hill. For example, thank you to those of you whose bosses voted for and authorized the WIN Act, which authorized the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, the GLRI, for 5 years at $300 million a year. That just happened at the end of last year. So keep that in mind as we march forward with all of our panelists today, who are all excellent. I've had the chance to work with all of these organizations. Some quick history, because it's always good if you want to know about where things are going, it's always good to know about where they have been. The GLRI has its roots in a program called the Great Lakes Legacy Act, which got a lot of bipartisan support with funding to help clean up areas of concern. The program was authorized in 2002 and then again in 2008, and it was so successful, had so much bipartisan support, that Congress went on to broaden it to cover more than just the cleanup of areas of concern. And that took the shape, that iteration took the shape of the GLRI. So when you think about the GLRI, we talk about it as if it has existed for the past 7 or 8 years. Actually, in different variations of it, it has existed for more than a decade and a half, which is a very impressive run for any program. In FY10, we, amongst the federal departments, put out an action plan to be able to invest the dollars that came through the GLRI. And that action plan hasn't changed a whole heck of a lot over the years. It is dedicated to and prioritizes the cleanup of toxic hotspot areas of concern. You're going to hear a little bit about AOCs in other presentations, but these are real places, real communities in the states across the Great Lakes Basin, and they're vital to clean up. We have had AOCs on the list since 1987, and it has only really been since the GLRI, the Legacy Act, and now the GLRI came along that the accelerator has been punched, and these AOCs are now being cleaned up, monitored, and then ultimately delisted. The action plan also prioritized work to keep invasive species out of the Great Lakes and to control them if they were in. The totem for this is, of course, anybody? Come on, so shy. Come on. Anybody? Yes, thank you for somebody saying it, Asian carp. And I'll talk a little bit about that soon. But Asian carp is a big one. There are, at any given time, multiple threats, but that's the one you hear most about. Non-point source runoff is another one from agricultural areas, but also urban and suburban too, like the kind that contribute to harmful algal blooms. Another one is habitat restoration. We have lost a lot of habitat in the form of wetlands across the upper Midwest. Why is this a big deal? Because wetlands help prevent flooding that cause private property damage. Wetlands help with increasing water quality. It's not just the job of sewage treatment plants to improve water quality around the region. It's also something that wetlands do. And then there's a catch-all part of the action plan that deals with education, deals with climate change, and deals with accountability. And on the accountability front, let me make this point. This is an important one to take home to your LDs and your chiefs of staff. There are what we call measures of progress in this action plan. These are annualized benchmarks of success. So as you think about the GLRI, don't just think about the environment, don't just think about the Great Lakes and water quality. Really, think about it as a good model for interdepartmental coordination and a model that lends itself to accountability. Every single year, you and Congress can look at that action plan and look at our report, look at the reports to Congress and see how much progress has been made. Let me also mention this. The GLRI has been through the ringer. Just about everybody and their aunt has looked at the GLRI to see how effective it is. It has been through two GAO studies. It has been reviewed in some parts by EPA's own Office of the Inspector General. It has also been reviewed by the Congressional Research Service. And at every instance, there were recommendations on how to strengthen it, but by and large, the program has always come out with flying colors as being very effective. That hasn't changed. The next action plan, first one came out in 2010. The next one came out in 2014, and it came out the month after the Toledo drinking water incident. I mentioned before that one of the priorities for the GLRI is reducing harmful algal blooms. One of the reasons we prioritized non-point runoff in the action plan was to keep reducing fertilizer at the source, upstream of these places like Toledo, like in the Saginaw, River and Bay, like in the Fox River and Green Bay in Wisconsin. These are places that have endured hypoxia, have endured harmful algal blooms, and the situation is not getting better with a changing climate. We know this. And that's why the action plan and the GLRI helps to invest in voluntary measures to help reduce those fertilizer inputs downstream. The next action plan would come out in 2019, if you all keep insisting on it, which I hope you do, and that will be an important one. One of the things that we heard frequently from our stakeholders, this is industry, this is NGOs, this is academia, this is the states, the tribes, the municipalities, is that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is intended to tackle big, long-standing, seemingly intractable problems. It is not intended to be a quick hit, quick fix program. There's your second take-home message. The GLRI is not intended, it never has been, to be the kind of program where you give a grant here, you give a grant there, and you just nibble away at the tiny problems, the low-hanging fruit. It's intended to get at the very high-hanging fruit, meaning the really tough problems. And to do that, it takes years. It takes decades in order to really make progress on those things. The GLRI cannot function if it is just going to be a 1 or a 2 year program. How is it a model of good government? Because of the coordination. And here's, I know we're all policy wonks in this room. That's why I love talking to you guys, because I feel like I'm with my brothers and sisters. Here's your policy wonk moment for the afternoon. How do we coordinate under the GLRI? It's called the Interagency Task Force, or the IATF. In 2004, President Bush signed an executive order that created a task force comprised of these 11 departments that I referred to earlier that would sit down constantly and keep looking at the priorities, keep designing budgets that were intended to invest in these priorities, and then make sure that those results were being achieved. That's what the IATF does, created by executive order. And it's because of that that coordination that the GLRI has been so effective. There's a regional working group that meets, also frequently comprised of regional directors in the Great Lakes region, that reports up to the IATF. About half of the budget, I'm about ready to get to the third take-home message here, about half of the GLRI budget goes to EPA, and the other half goes to all of the other federal departments. So, the GLRI is an interdepartmental program. It is not just an EPA program. Even though the GLRI budget goes first to the EPA, it then gets distributed, broadcasted out through the other departments, some of which have grant programs, some of which do the work themselves, and so forth. So the GLRI is an interdepartmental program. And the focus is on results, results, results. And that's why you see, I think, such great support. Where are the threats to the GLRI now? Believe it or not, I'm actually not going to talk about the PresBud. I'm going to talk about a few other things, because I think we're all aware of the recent proposed budget. But one of the threats, I think, is to agencies' own base budgets. For the GLRI to be effective, agency base budgets have to be strong. They have to be healthy. It's not just, for example, the Great Lakes National Program Office at EPA, situated in Chicago, that works to deliver the results that you're going to hear about. Okay? It is also EPA's Air Office. It is also EPA's Office of Water. It is also the Office of Research and Development. It's the Policy Shop. That's just EPA, for example. So, if the budget for the agency is reduced, that also will have an impact on the GLRI, because the rest of the agency plays a very important support role for the effectiveness of the program. One of the things that you hear, I heard it working for the previous administration, the Obama administration, is that the GLRI is not spending money fast enough. And that is not true. There is $300 million going in, and there is $300 million going out. What we have, when we hear that argument, is that $300 million should be going out and being obligated in the first year to 2 years of from the time that the money is appropriated. Again, the purpose of the program is to deal with large-scale very difficult problems, very hard, multi-year projects. Very hard to do that in a year to 2 year. There's a quick and easy fix to this, and it's been done before. There's lots of precedent, and that is no-year appropriations. The Superfund program has that. Buildings and facilities, there are several other kinds of funding programs that fall under a no-year appropriation. That could help. Why? Because there are projects that are shovel-ready, they're ready to go, have a lot of support, and then they bump into a wall. Great example is in Ohio, the Ballville Dam, for those of you who may have heard of it. The designs were there, the projects were all built, the project was underway, and then a lawsuit happened. And that lawsuit slowed down the project. No fault of any of the project proponents, no fault of the agencies, just an outside influence, a dynamic changed, and that was that. No-year appropriations could help with those kinds of dynamics. One of the other arguments you're going to hear is that, well, the states can pick up the slack on the GLRI. Not true. The states are already doing a great deal of work, and Matt Doss is here with the Great Lakes Commission, one of the best organizations we have representing the states. The municipalities can't pick up the slack. The last big study they did showed that the municipalities are funding Great Lakes restoration and protection to the tune of about $5 billion a year. Tribes can't pick up the slack. And the federal government has designed a program here that is cost-sharing. In other words, under the GLRI, under some aspects of it, for the federal government provides 50 to 65% of the funding. The remainder comes from state and private sources. So we already have a program that requires, in many aspects, different players to come to the table and put some skin in the game. You start to pull out threads from that, federal funding goes away or gets reduced, you start to see the collapse from those other sources as well. So that argument, I don't think, really holds up. The GLRI is also of national importance. There were many instances in which we would fund and invest in projects that could that resulted in the development of technologies that could be transferred elsewhere around the country. In other words, the GLRI is an innovation lab of sorts to help develop technologies and practices and approaches that can work elsewhere. So the argument that this is a regional problem, when you have 95% of the nation's fresh surface water, I would differ with that. It is a program of national importance. We also have Canada as a partner. That's very important to remember. We don't own the Great Lakes here. We share it with Canada. And Canada is a very important partner. Reducing federal funding then raises a bunch of questions about our own commitments under a variety of pacts and agreements and treaties about our obligations with our neighbor to the north. Final thing I'll say in closing is one of the big priorities under the GLRI has been funding work to prevent migration of Asian carp into the Great Lakes. And to be able to do that, the agencies pulled together something called the Asian Carp Regional Coordinating Committee. That was and is today, I think, another great model of coordination among federal, state, provincial, and other agencies as well. However, with the change, if a drastic change in the budget occurs, we know several things. Number one, EPA's own ability to play a coordination role is at risk. And EPA has a very important role in ensuring fiscal responsibility to help keep Asian carp out under the GLRI. The other thing that we know is that Illinois, whose waterways are leading to Lake Michigan from the Mississippi River, doesn't have a whole lot of money to be able to spend on Asian carp. In fact, most of Illinois' efforts are funded by the GLRI. A reduction in the GLRI can mean a reduction in coordination authority, and it can ultimately mean a reduction in Illinois' ability to keep Asian carp out. So that is my quick fire speed dating, hope you like it, presentation about the GLRI. And Matt, I'm happy to answer questions after everybody's done speaking.
Thank you, Ken. Now Matt Doss, talk about some of the AOC cleanup work with people.
Hi. As Matt said, my name is Chad Lord. I'm with the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition, as Matt said. The Healing Our Waters Coalition is an organization of 145 non-governmental organizations, national, state, region-wide and local groups that came together just over 10 years ago to work on Great Lakes restoration and protection issues. The Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is our top priority. I want to thank the Northeast Midwest Institute for inviting us to present today. I would encourage, if your offices are not members of the Great Lakes Task Force, to take back to your offices and encourage. I would encourage you all to join. It's a great opportunity for people to stay on top of what's happening in the Great Lakes region. A couple of other points that I want to just say in terms of to springboard off of what Cam was talking about, which I think are particularly important about the GLRI, before I begin talking about areas of concern, which is a particular area of success for the program. First of all, the GLRI is bipartisan. It's been supported by two different presidents of both parties. It's been supported by members of both parties here in Capitol Hill, governors throughout the region of both parties, state legislators and mayors. So it's a very bipartisan effort. The GLRI is supplementary funding. It sits on top of the base budgets of other agencies, meaning that the base budgets of other agencies are critical in order to get the work done. And that the GLRI is the work that comes out of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative is built on shared priorities that are shared not only between the federal agencies, but priorities that are shared between the federal agencies, the state agencies, city agencies, non-governmental organizations, tribal nations, and others. So, as Cam said, half of the money for the GLRI stays at EPA. A big part of that goes to cleaning up areas of concern, which is what I'll talk about today. Next, can we go to the next slide? That's not the one. The first slide. There we go. I want to go back and take time just to talk a little bit about areas of concern and how they get cleaned up, because I think it's important for folks to understand that what we're talking about today are very complicated problems that have been that have existed for a very long time. As you can see here, the Great Lakes areas of concern were designated in 1987 under the Great Lakes Water Quality Agreement, an agreement that the United States reached with our neighbors of the North Canada all the way back into beginning in 1972. In 1987, they revised the agreement, and at that time, they set aside and designated 43 locations throughout the region as particularly polluted spots that needed to have special attention. Next slide. So here's how it's defined. The Water Quality Agreement defines AOCs as geographic areas designated by the parties, which would be the United States and Canada, where significant impairment of beneficial uses has occurred as a result of human activities at the local level. An AOC is a location that has experienced environmental degradation. And so these beneficial use impairments would be anything from beach closings to fish tumors to water and other water quality issues. Next slide. So as I already noted, there were 43 areas of concern in 1987. 26 of those areas of concern were here in the United States, completely in the United States. Five of them were binational, meaning that they sat between the two countries of the United States and Canada, and 12 were in Canada. Next slide. And this is what that looks like when you take a look at the distribution of all of those various areas of concern that were established in 1987. I said that there were 43 areas of concern. That number has actually been reduced. There were three areas of concern in Canada that have been delisted: Collingwood Harbor, Severn Harbor, and Wheatley Harbor. And the people from the Canadian Embassy could correct me on my pronunciations of any of those. And there have been four U.S. areas of concern that have been delisted: the White Lake and Deer Lake, both in Michigan; Presque Isle Bay in Pennsylvania; and the Oswego River area of concern, which was the first area of concern in the United States that was delisted back in July of 2006. Next slide. So this is the process for which an area of concern gets delisted. Every area of concern begins with an evaluation of the conditions in that area. They're geographically defined, and the communities that are in these areas study the problems. They find out what's going on. They find out where the toxic sediments are, where the habitat needs to be restored. And so they evaluate these conditions, and they come up with plans. And then they implement the actions that are necessary to do those plans. after they take those actions, they assess what happened, and then if there looks to be that they actually remove those beneficial use impairments, they propose, they actually then formally propose the removal of the BUI. There is a vigorous public consultation process that happens within each area of concern, all the way around this circle here, from the evaluation of conditions, the implementation of actions, but in particular when you're removing a BUI or actually delisting an area of concern, there is a vigorous public process to ensure that what's actually happening is agreed to by the communities. And if everyone agrees and then a BUI or beneficial use impairment is removed, and if all of those beneficial use impairments are removed, then the area can be petitioned to be delisted and taken off the list of a toxic hotspot. As already noted, the public is involved throughout this process through local committees, and all of this work is based on science and significant monitoring to ensure that we're proving that what is being said is happening in these areas is actually happening. Next slide. So this is kind of so up, between 1987 and 2002, there wasn't really all that much action in terms of the delisting of BUIs and the delisting of areas of concern. And so Congress acted. In 2002, Congress passed the Great Lakes Legacy Act to try and invigorate the process in which invigorate the process to clean up these toxic hotspots. And the first appropriations for the Great Lakes Legacy Act occurred in 2004. The Great Lakes Legacy Act was reauthorized in 2008. I go through this timeline because you'll note that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative was established in 2010. I wanted to go through this timeline to just reemphasize that what we've been doing in the region just didn't start with the GLRI, but has been going on for a very long time. The Great Lakes Legacy Act has now been subsumed by the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, and the money for the Great Lakes Legacy Act is actually paid out under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. So for nearly 20 years after 1987, when the first AOC was delisted, it took nearly 20 years to delist the first U.S. AOC, and then it took an additional 7 years for the second AOC to be delisted, which was Presque Isle Bay in Pennsylvania in 2013. Just so you know, the Great Lakes Legacy Act and all of these GLRI sediment remediation work is matched by the federal government. 35% comes from the non-federal partners. More so if it's being sponsored by a corporate partner, and then 65% can be used from the federal government. So what are the results that we're seeing through the AOC project? Well, 4 AOCs have been delisted since the project has begun, since the 50 beneficial use impairments at 18 areas of concern and 8 Great Lakes states have been removed. That's under the GLRI. This is all under the GLRI. That's 5 times the total amount that had been removed under the preceding 22 years. Over 3.5 million cubic yards of sediment have been remediated. This is what that looks like. You'll see a huge jump of the beneficial use impairments removed at Great Lakes areas of concern beginning in 2010, and that's when the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative began. So you can see the influence that the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative has had on the ability to clean up these toxic hotspots from the beginning. And this is just what the delisting looked like. So I'm going to go through 2 areas of concern just by way of providing some local examples. So the first is Buffalo River. This is the groundness and geography. This is what that looks like. The Buffalo River's watershed looks like. The Buffalo River empties into eastern Lake Erie right before Lake Erie drains into the Niagara River before on its way to Lake Ontario. The Buffalo River is an internationally award-winning and globally recognized restoration success story of how environmental restoration can lead to local economic recovery. In 1967, the Buffalo River was declared biologically dead. President Johnson toured the Buffalo River at that time and Lake Erie and was disgusted and used his authority at the time in an executive order to basically prohibit dumping of sludge into Lake Erie. It's important to note that the Buffalo River actually caught on fire 2 months before the Cuyahoga did. At least that's what the Buffalo River folks say. So I think it just kind of underscores the degree in which the Buffalo River was polluted. And you can see here's a picture of the Buffalo River. This quote comes from a statement by the United States Department of the Interior where they talked about it, you know, the Buffalo River is repulsive, you know, being having a boundless mosaic of color from the chemicals that were on top of the waterway. The river, as I already said, was considered to be biologically dead. You know, the GLRI has really turned this situation around. This is an example of a project in the Buffalo River that the GLRI helped fund, and this is some shoreline habitat restoration activity. Through the unique partnership that was formed between a nonprofit, the Buffalo River Niagara Riverkeeper, public, local, state, and federal agencies, and private industry, Honeywell in this case, they have invested millions of dollars in federal funding, local funding, and private funding to clean up this area. The Buffalo River partners have leveraged $25 million in GLRI investment to secure another $25 million from state and private sources for the cleanup of this river, and it has catalyzed another $150 million in private investments towards mixed-use development along the restored riverfront. Anecdotally, there is a sharp increase in outdoor recreation activity and ecotourism now. Without the GLRI or these investments from the US EPA, none of this would have happened. The economic revival in the city of Buffalo's waterfront is directly correlated to the health and restoration of its water resources, and the GLRI and the EPA have played critical roles for the city of Buffalo and other Great Lakes cities in western New York. So if you go to the next slide, this is another example of the Riverbend site that's also been restored. And if you remember that site, that slide where they had the quotes about the boundless, the repulsive river and the mosaic of color, well, this is what that looks like now. People are actually now enjoying boating and other recreational activities on the Buffalo River. And that's just one of the dredgers that was used to get rid of some of the toxic sediment. The other AOC that I want to briefly talk about is the St. Louis River, which is in Minnesota and is considered to be the headwaters of the Great Lakes. Here is, give this some geographic scope. It empties between the cities of Duluth and Superior, Wisconsin, into Lake Superior. This is what that area of Duluth looked like, and why this area became so polluted. Much of what was being produced at the steel mills and other industrial plants in this area were dumped into the water. Some of which was dumped into the water, causing contaminated sediment that could be anywhere between 5, 7, 12 feet deep in some places. In July 2013, the region's Remedial Action Plan, which is the cleanup plan, was approved. This was a plan that over 40 partners came together and developed. Under this plan, they came up with 70 cleanup actions that was designed to remove all 9 beneficial use impairments in this region, and they wanted to make sure that this work was completed by 2020. They're hoping to delist this area of concern by 2025. They are currently in the fifth year of implementation. Here's the plan as it looks like on a map. All these colors represent various toxic spots that need to be cleaned up and the habitat improved in order for them to meet their benchmarks. And this is the progress that is currently underway. This chart comes from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and it shows that they are making significant progress in meeting their goals, but they still need additional work to do the most difficult work, which is actually remediating and pulling out those toxic sediments that are sitting in the bottom of the St. Louis River and the Duluth Superior Harbor. So these are two pictures of what some of that work looks like. This is Chambers Grove Shoreline, which is a softening and restoration project. So the areas of concern aren't just about taking out the toxic chemicals out of the sediments, but also restoring the habitat along the shorelines. So this is one of the examples. And then this is slip two, which was a contaminated sediment cleanup. So on the left, you can see the actual work that's been going on. And on the right, you can see a new hotel that was built to accommodate people that are now going to Duluth to spend time outdoors. As I already noted, while they're making great progress in the St. Louis area of concern, there's still a lot of work to do. And one of the things that just happened was that the Minnesota legislature has approved a significant bond of over $25 million to go towards the cleanup of the St. Louis area of concern. That bond would serve as the match for a Great Lakes Legacy Act project to do the sediment remediation projects that are necessary, as you saw on one of the former slides. This money could be left on the table if the president's budget is approved and the GLRI is eliminated, because there would be no federal funds to go towards matching the money that the state has put up for itself. And then these are just some of the benefits of some of the local cleanups. So I hope the takeaway here is that the GLRI, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, has done a lot of work in helping move forward the cleanups of these areas of concern. Communities have acted together, working together in a collaborative way to develop plans of action. They're taking that action, and that they're seeing the results.
All right. So as previously stated, my name is Whitney Taney. I am the Senior Water Policy Advisor for Ducks Unlimited. Who in the room knows what Ducks Unlimited is? So a few of you. So we are the world's leading wetlands conservation organization, and today I'm going to take an opportunity to talk about a specific project that we have worked on, as well as what the program means to Ducks Unlimited as a whole. So since the program's creation in 2010, DO has received grant funding to enhance, conserve, and protect wetlands across the basin states. With this funding, DU has actually been involved in 64 projects, which has impacted over 18,000 acres across all the Great Lakes states. We have worked with more than 80 partners to accomplish this, which is a testament not only to the success of the program, but also the fact that it really facilitates these broad partnerships across the board to reach our conservation goals. These restored wetlands filter polluted water rolling off the landscape, provide habitat for over 900 different species, including several different species of types of ducks, and serve as hubs for outdoor recreation. With GLRI funding, we are able to leverage the funding with state and private dollars many times over to stretch this money across the landscape even further. This amplification of conservation dollars is why we're able to have such a big effect at a large scale. One such GLR project that I wanted to highlight is the Howard Marsh Project, which is in Toledo, Ohio, which you can see here on the screens now. We've got some aerial shots that'll kind of cycle through, because it's kind of the best way to show the scale of these. But you've got Lake Erie that's right up along there. As I said, it's east of Toledo. And here, Ducks Unlimited, the landowner, Toledo Metro Parks, and the Ohio Division of Wildlife and others are restoring over 1,000 acres of agricultural land that previously was creating a lot of discharge into Lake Erie. It's Ohio's 9th congressional district, so Congresswoman Kaptur actually represents that area. And for the restoration, NOAA gave Ducks Unlimited a grant of $2.83 million, and of that funding we then were able to do the wetland restoration and the water quality components pieces, but then we were able to take that funding and leverage it even further, which is something that is really exciting about this program in general. So we leveraged it over 3-to-1, with funding also coming in from Toledo Metro Parks, Ohio Division of Wildlife, and Ducks Unlimited. We also kicked in some money as well. So what's exciting about this for us too is what it does for the local communities on the ground. So your local contractors and suppliers are utilizing those project dollars to do the dirt moving, the demoing of old buildings, erecting new structures, planting trees, planting new grasses, doing the consult and permitting and leasing and all of those kind of activities. And this money from GLRI has become this economic ripple across the region, in the sense that it really provides a lot of high-paying jobs, which of course is something very important during these economic times. So in addition to the obvious benefits to your wildlife and fish, the restoration of Howard Marsh will also help to improve the water quality of Lake Erie. The previous active agriculture was, as I said, creating a lot of this discharge that was flowing directly into the lake. But with restoration, wetlands create this nice little filter. It's almost like a coffee filter where you get rid of all of those sediments as well as the other kind of nasty discharge. So once complete, the Howard Marsh will be open to the public for a variety of outdoor recreation opportunities, including waterfowl hunting, which is something we're excited about, but also fishing, trapping, hiking, bird watching, kayaking, and canoeing. And these outdoor activities really fuel Ohio's economy and are especially important to the economic health of smaller communities that are based around these projects. So now let's dig into the economics and what this actually means. So as hunters and anglers, we spend over $90 billion annually in pursuit of our outdoor passions. And then if you bring that even further to your other outdoor recreation pursuits, so you add in your hikers, your canoers, your kayakers, the Outdoor Industry Association just put out their latest report for 2017, which boasts over 7.6 million jobs directly supported by such work, as well as $887 billion in consumer spending on activities like, as I mentioned, the canoeing, kayaking, et cetera. So this is huge, especially for some of these smaller places. So this outdoor economy and culture rely heavily on the healthy habitats, because we can't go hunting if there's not a healthy habitat. Professionally managed fish and wildlife populations, that's part of the reason why they have bag limits and everything else, and why hunting and fishing can be very important. And it gives us access and places to go to recreate, which is extremely important. So the Howard Marsh Project is just one of these examples, but as you guys are exiting, I hope you do pick up one of our little pamphlets that shows exactly where all 64 projects are happening. But I just also kind of want to take the opportunity to mention, with President Trump's budget, the Howard Marsh will lose the ability to do the second phase. There's 250 more acres that are kind of left in limbo unless there is GLRI funding that is available, basically, at this point. So this is real life. These are real jobs. These are real opportunities that potentially could lose out for future generations.
Thank you. My name is Matt Doss. I'm policy director for the Great Lakes Commission, and the commission was formed in 1955 to work on behalf of the eight states that border on the Great Lakes. We're based in Ann Arbor and have a professional staff of about 25 to 30 people. So again, our clients, the people we work with, are the eight Great Lakes states, and you need to go to the opening slide. The GLRI is a top priority for us. There's a variety of materials out front, fact sheets, and our annual federal priorities that we bring to the Hill every year, plus fact sheets for each of the eight Great Lakes states, telling a little bit about what the GLRI is doing in your states. So I just want to emphasize that this is a huge priority for the Great Lakes states, not just because of the cleaning up the environment, but also the economic benefits of the GLRI. Before I go on, as protocol, I would certainly want to recognize some special people here in the audience, and that would include my son, Alec, who's in his second week as an intern here on Capitol Hill. So hope you're working hard and doing your time on the phones and opening mail, Alec. So please say hello to him when you see him around. Do you still get mail here? Yeah? Okay. Anyway, it's great to be here. I want to thank the Northeast Midwest Institute. They're a great partner with us in our Great Lakes work. And encourage your offices, if you're not a member of the task force, to become a member. And I can say for sure that the people in the Great Lakes region really care deeply about the Great Lakes, and there's been a huge outcry over the proposed elimination of the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And I can bet that you are hearing this in your calls and the emails and the mail that you're getting. So there's a couple things you can do to respond to your constituents, and that is, one, vote for continued funding for the GLRI, and two, become a member of the Great Lakes Task Force if you're not, because that will demonstrate your boss's commitment to the Great Lakes. So I noted that the Great Lakes Commission was formed in 1955, and that was when the St. Lawrence Seaway was opened. And so really, part of our original founding purpose was to support commercial navigation in the Great Lakes. But our mission and our compact and the charter that formed us is much broader and really looks at both the environmental and the economic health of the region. And that's why I have this selection of pictures up here to emphasize the environment, recreation, recreational boating and fishing, and commercial navigation, because all those are important to us. And the GLRI really is making a difference in all these areas. Next slide. So these are just some quick factoids about the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes region. Our region and the Great Lakes are really an economic engine for our region and our nation as a whole. For example, the vast majority of iron ore that supports steel production in our country comes from the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and Minnesota, and it comes through the Sioux Locks from the St. Mary's River, which connects Lake Superior and Lake Huron. So again, think about that. Almost all the iron ore we need to produce steel in this country comes through that one location. So one of our priorities, which is not necessarily a GLRI priority, is to build a new large lock there. There's a lot of work going on right now, and we hope we'll see that as part of a large infrastructure package. But you can see the other factoids here. The majority of the, about a third of our population lives in the Great Lakes region, about a third of our economic activity. The Great Lakes generate hundreds of thousands of jobs and billions in business revenue. The Great Lakes navigation system is the longest deep water navigation system in the world, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean about 2,300 miles all the way to Duluth, which is the end of that system. It produces a couple hundred thousand jobs and $33 billion in business revenue for our region. And then fishing, hunting, and boating in the Great Lakes region generate about $52 billion. Nearly a third of all the registered boats in the United States are in the Great Lakes region. So the Great Lakes are a natural treasure, but they're also a huge economic asset for our region. So when we talk about the GLRI, certainly cleaning up contaminated sediments, restoring shorelines, restoring native habitat and fish and wildlife populations is critical, but it also is an economic development program for our region and particularly for a lot of local communities. So I just want to, next slide, please. So again, I just want to emphasize this blue water economy that we talk about in the region and that people are really recognizing as a key to our future prosperity. We are a water-rich region in a water-scarce world. Fresh water, fresh, clean water is going to be an increasingly scarce and valuable commodity throughout the rest of this century. And we have 20% of the world's supply of fresh surface water and about 95% of our nation's supply of fresh surface water. So that gives us a huge competitive advantage to attract industries that depend on reliable sources of clean surface water, as well as people that want to live by clean water. We're seeing people increasingly coming back to the waterfront. We turned our backs on the water over the last century because they were polluted. That's where we dumped our sewage and industrial waste. And as we've cleaned up these water bodies, people are increasingly coming back to them. They want to live on them in condos. They want to recreate them on them in kayaks. So this is a hugely important resource for us for all the reasons that I have up there. Next slide. So Matt wanted me to talk a little bit about economic benefits from restoring the Great Lakes. In 2007, the Brookings Institution here in Washington, D.C. did a comprehensive study on the projected economic benefits of implementing our restoration strategy, and they projected that there would be over $50 billion in long-term benefits. And we're really starting to see some of that in some of these areas of concern, these local communities that are cleaning up and revitalizing and reusing the formerly degraded shoreline areas. And Chad talked about a few, and I'll talk about a few more. So again, that just emphasizes that it's not just about correcting environmental mistakes of the past, but it's really creating a more prosperous, successful future for our region and for our communities. NOAA does a study every year, and they find that the ocean and Great Lakes economy is growing at three times the rate of the overall national economy. So that just emphasizes the importance of economic activity in that coastal zone. Improving water quality, restoring degraded shorelines is really facilitating development in waterfront areas. And again, I'll show some more examples of that. We're seeing increased property values in these shoreline areas. We're leveraging private sector investment. And we're seeing a positive return on the investment. Chad talked about the Great Lakes Legacy Act.
which really has been pivotal in accelerating the cleanup of contaminated sediments in the areas of concern, which is really the core problem in those areas. Without that program, we would not see anywhere near the progress that we've seen in the last 10 years. About 40% of the funding for those sediment cleanups has come from non-federal sources, whether it be the states through environmental bond programs like Michigan and Minnesota, or through industries that have some level of responsibility and have used that program to cost share with the federal government. So GLRI and federal leadership are critical, but the states and local communities and industries are definitely stepping up to the table to play a role in this. I got some logos there at the bottom of some organizations that we work with that have endorsed the GLRI, have been good partners with us: the American Great Lakes Ports Association, the Great Lakes Metro Chambers of Commerce Coalition, the Council of Great Lakes Industries, and the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence Cities Initiative. And I put those there because you would expect the major environmental organizations, NWF, Sierra Club, and whatnot, to support the GLRI. But we see many industry, business, consumer groups, and cities that also have supported this program because of its importance for helping local economies. Next slide. So I'm going to talk about some sort of case studies here of the effect that GLRI cleanups have had on some communities. This is pictures of Muskegon, Michigan, which is on the east shore of Lake Michigan, and pretty much directly across the lake from Milwaukee. Muskegon was originally a lumber town back when Michigan was a great source of lumber. The lumber from the rebuilt Chicago after the Chicago fire, a lot of that came through Muskegon Harbor. So after the lumbering era, they turned to foundries and other heavy industry. And you can see the picture on the top left of the industrial shoreline of Muskegon probably around 1940, 1950. Many of the tanks and jeeps in World War II were built in Muskegon in some of these facilities right here. A lot of those industries have gone away, and so the south shore of Muskegon Lake is almost totally denuded of heavy industry. They recently lost their last paper mill and their electric coal-fired power plant. So this community has been very committed and very strategic in investing in cleaning up contaminated sediments and restoring that shoreline. And the statistics I'm showing up there was for one large-scale coastal restoration project that was actually done under the Recovery Act that invested $10 million. And we did an economic benefit analysis and found that over 10 years, it would generate $66 million in economic benefits. So that's a 6-to-1 return on investment, attract 65,000 new visitors each year, raise property values by $12 million. So this is a good example of how the community is really leveraging the assets that it has to build a better future. Next slide. This is Ashtabula. The Ashtabula River flows into Lake Erie east of Cleveland, and they have a very important port, one of the 10 busiest ports on the Great Lakes, but it was clogged with contaminated sediments. So that really restricted the ability to dredge that river to allow freighters to come in. Under the Great Lakes Legacy Act, again, part of the GLRI, they did one of the largest contaminated sediment cleanups in the Great Lakes, removed, I think, 600,000 cubic yards of contaminated sediments. And Cam, you've been involved with all these projects, so you can correct me if I get any of these numbers wrong. And not only was that good for the environment, but that allowed them to completely dredge that river and restore the recreational boating and the commercial shipping that comes into it. So when they can't dredge these rivers, these freighters have to what's called light load. They can't load as heavy because they can't go down deep enough before they hit the floor of the river. And that's bad for them economically. Because of removing the contaminated sediments, they've been able to restore the depth in that river and to allow complete commercial navigation to really help maintain the future economic viability of this for shipping. Next slide. And this is Buffalo River again that Chad talked about. Another case study of a river that was pretty awful 20, 30, 40 years ago and really has made a dramatic turnaround. The top left there, that is the Riverbend area. and that's where there's been considerable amount of contaminated sediments removed, shoreline restoration, and together with investments from the state of New York and private investors, that's resulting in quite a bit of investment and shoreline development. This is a solar panel factory called Solar City. When it's completed, it's going to be the largest solar panel factory in the Western Hemisphere. And that company is committed to investing somewhere around $5 billion over the next decade, and it's projected to create about 6,000 jobs here on the banks of the Buffalo River. So another case where, you know, industries went away and new ones are coming in. But what's interesting is this factory, when it's at full operation, is going to employ more people than the steel mill that was at that site originally. So I just think this is really a good story all around. And Chad showed the pictures of people kayaking and the other kind of recreation on that river. So we can have this commercial activity next door to great recreational activities on these rivers. Next slide. And this is a Kinnickinnick River. This is just south of downtown Milwaukee. And again, this was another river that was clogged with contaminated sediments. You can see it on the left there. I think there was 12 or 14 feet of contaminated sediments that, again, prevented them from dredging out that sediment that needs to be done periodically in all the rivers in the Great Lakes just because of the natural sedimentation. When that sediment is clean, they can dredge it out and use it for beach nourishment and other uses. When it's contaminated, they can't. So they weren't able to dredge this river, and it really constrained the uses of it for different types of businesses. A local business development district came together, and again, leveraging funding under the Great Lakes Legacy Act, were able to dredge that river, and it was able to revitalize businesses in the area. This is a brew pub, and I love mentioning this every time. The name of the brew pub is the Horny Goat, and that's the truth. I'm not making that up. And another great use of shoreline property. Next slide. And finally, this is Detroit. I think you probably all are aware of some of the challenges that Detroit has had over the years. Unfortunately, unlike Chicago did a great job of preserving their waterfront, for those of you that have been there. Unfortunately, Detroit didn't do that as much. They built industries right up to the shore and really prevented it from being a place that people wanted to go and recreate and walk. Over the last decade, there's been about $1.5 billion in public and private funds invested in this Detroit Riverwalk, riverfront area. You can see the Renaissance Center there in the background that has created about a mile of improved shoreline, walkways, green landscapes, parks, and whatnot. And this is generating about $50 million annually in revenue and jobs. And it really is revitalizing this stretch of the riverfront, and it's expected to attract a lot more investment in coming years. Next slide. And this is the Port Huron. So this is on the St. Clair River, right where Lake Huron spills into the St. Clair River, then flowing down towards Detroit. On the top left, this was an old area for depositing salt and limestone and other kind of materials, just kind of a degraded area. And eventually it was no longer being used for this. So a public-private partnership was created and leveraged about $6 million to create this Blue Water Riverwalk along a mile of this formerly industrial shoreline, and really has made a really nice area. The picture on the bottom left is actually an old rail ferry. So they would put a rail car on there and take it across the river to Canada. And it's no longer being used, but they preserved it as kind of an artifact of the past, and people now are having weddings there. The picture on the bottom right is actually an outdoor classroom, and so they put in walkways, and they're restoring habitat along this area, and it's really become a nice feature for this city. The downtown area of Port Huron is just adjacent to this, so it's been a nice complement to economic development in that area. Next slide. And finally, this is Monroe, Michigan, down in the far southeast corner of Michigan, south of Detroit, on the River Raisin. And it was clogged with contaminated sediments and quite a few dams that were preventing fish from passing. So again, under the Great Lakes Legacy Act, they removed the sediments. Ford was one of the large cost-share partners in that cleanup. And then they removed or they bypassed a number of the dams. And the dam removals are really a great opportunity in the Great Lakes because dams are really damaging to native fish. They prevent them from passing upstream to spawn and get to habitat. And so, and one of the things I've learned is that when you take out a dam or provide a way for fish to get by, the fish populations actually react and respond pretty quickly. I'm not a fish biologist, but that's what I've been told. So this is a great opportunity for this community, again, to revitalize this river. And just in recent years, they've established a new national battlefield park, the River Raisin National Battlefield Park. There was a big battle there in the War of 1812. And so they're kind of combining this all into part of an overall revitalization for this downtown area by the river and the battlefield park. So another case where the environmental cleanup is leveraging and complementing other economic development opportunities that these communities are undertaking. And again, it's a part of that process of bringing people back to the water, back to these waterfronts, in a way that wouldn't have been possible 20, 30, 40 years ago when they smelled and were full of contaminated sediments, when there was no fishery, and they just weren't an attractive place to go. And one other little anecdote that I just heard this week, the Maumee River in Toledo has had a number of large contaminated sediment cleanups in recent years. And before that, the fish in one of those areas were so contaminated that if you caught a fish and then threw it back, you'd be violating federal law by throwing contaminated material into the river. Now, they completed that sediment cleanup about, I don't know, 6, 8 years ago, Cam, the Ottawa River. And now the health of the fish has responded to the extent that you can actually catch and eat those fish. So that's a great success story, because I personally think it's pretty outrageous that we can't eat the fish that we pull out of the Great Lakes. So that's the end for my talk. Please use us at the Great Lakes Commission as a resource. There's materials out there with my name and contact information. We have an online searchable database and map on our website showing all the GLRI projects that are underway. You can overlay county and district boundary maps to show those projects that are underway in your congressional district. So that can be a good resource for you if you need to respond to constituents or help your boss speak at events. So I've gone beyond my 12 minutes, but there's a lot of good stories to tell, so I hope it's helpful.
I just wanted to add a few more closing thoughts in terms of some of the results that we're seeing. We talked a lot about habitat and AOCs. But just to put a finer point on it, invasive species control, there's been controls done on over 100,000 acres across the region. Farmland under conservation has doubled in the Western Lake Erie, Saginaw Bay, and Green Bay areas. There's been more than 3,800 river miles that have been cleared of fish passages, like the one that we saw in the picture, and more than 150,000 acres of wetlands, coastal, upland, and island habitat has been protected, restored, and enhanced. And not to put too fine a point on it, but under the President's proposed budget to eliminate the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative, without any more additional funds for fiscal year 2018, work in the areas of concern will stop. Asian carp prevention, as you know, as was talked about, will slow. 40% of Asian carp prevention activities is funded under the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. Targeted polluted runoff work will end, which would mean that some of our targets in terms of reducing 1.8 million pounds of phosphorus from ag lands that are entering waterways and causing harmful algal blooms will remain on farm fields. 130 million gallons of urban runoff will continue to be untreated. There will be fewer wetlands restored, protected, and enhanced. The offices will close. Staff will be laid off, not only at the federal level, but at the state level. The GLRI actually sponsors state staff to actually help with the planning for many of these projects. That staff will get laid off. And the budget, I wouldn't even say what the budget under the President's budget request puts us back towards, because it puts us back towards pretty much to a time where we've never seen. So I hope everyone has gotten something out of that, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
So we have run a little bit over, but I think you guys have a little bit of time, right? So if there are questions, I think this would be a great time to ask them if you don't have them. So if you could just say which office you're
from. I'm from Lovin's office. This is for Cam. You mentioned the GLRI is sort of a national project that develops innovative technology that the entire country uses. Can you provide specific examples, please?
Sure. So, Alec, one of the examples that comes to mind is Zequinox. We funded USGS to help with the development of a targeted toxicant that could be used for zebra mussels, and it has been bench-scaled and piloted in some inland lakes in Michigan. So that's one example that comes to mind.
How do you spell that?
Zequinox. Z-E-Q-A-N-O-X. Yeah.
It's worth noting that the GLRI is also funding the research and development of control technologies for Asian carp. And we've made a lot of progress. Some of those are being tested in small areas of the Illinois River and some other rivers. But we're hoping that that's going to lead to some applications in the Illinois River to kind of create a block for Asian carp from getting closer to the Great Lakes, but in a way that still allows commercial navigation to get by. So that research has been largely funded by the GLRI.
I'll take advantage of the pause and the questions to mention, you know, one of the things that I've been impressed by now having moved to the private sector is how corporations are now coming forward to urge the preservation of the program. And I've got an energy utility or two, for example, that has come forward and said, we want your help. And because this program is really important to the private sector. It's not just for parks and recreation. It's not just to keep invasive species out. The business sector has really been keenly interested in making sure the program sticks around. Let me also mention, too, because I don't have enough cards for all of you, if you need to reach me, I'm at Cam Davis, CamDavis, at geiconsultants.com. Phone number is 312-985-0368. And I really do welcome questions because I can tell you're too shy to ask them here in a public forum if you have them later.
Cam, I'm going to put a follow-up email to get your information.
Even better.
And there's swag outside, some squeezy ducks and things like that, so make sure you take that stuff.
Do you have a question?
Sure. Can you talk about how you monitor success stories?
Can you just let us know what your name is in your office?
Sorry, I'm Amelia. I'm with the Market Business.
So how do the agencies keep track of success stories? There is a pretty rigorous reporting requirement if you get funding under the GLRI. Not just grantees under EPA programs, but also the other departments have to report back too. And these reports have to quantify how the project, how the funding has helped to advance the measures of progress that I mentioned in my presentation. There is an annual report to Congress that's supposed to come out every year. The last one, I think, came out in 2015. I think 2016 is stuck somewhere for anybody interested in trying to jar it loose.
Those are actually a really good, fairly concise resource for understanding the GLRI.
Lots of maps, lots of graphics. It's all, you know, very, the metrics are right there. And that's a report to the President and Congress on progress.
And I know the coalition, our Great Lakes Coalition, uses those reports to report out to you all the statistics I mentioned earlier, but it's also helpful to have human faces and human stories to go along with those numbers. And if you go to healthylakes.org or pick up the report that I put out on the table, you'll find the Healing Our Waters Great Lakes Coalition's attempt to document through a series of case studies actual projects where we talk about what that project is, what that project is doing, how that project benefits the environment, who's involved in that project, to really emphasize the multi-stakeholder kind of cooperation that goes on. So the projects that Ducks Unlimited is doing and leveraging the work with the private sector or the public sector, but also, and then the economic benefits that there are results. So we try to use the data that the federal agencies use, the data that the Great Lakes Commission has collected, and then actually do a deeper dive in a series of case studies that try and really highlight what's going on the ground in ways that I hope will be a little bit more understandable than saying that 3,800 river miles have been cleaned. We want to actually talk about the dam that's been removed and the types of things we're seeing as in terms of benefits.
And for folks that are in the room who have a boss that's really interested in coming to see some of these projects, we have many biologists and engineers on the ground in the Great Lakes that would love to get you and your boss out on the ground. So I'll have my cards. I'll get them out of my bag. But definitely please reach out, as this will continue to be an important issue for us.
I would just note that we actually would like to have better regional data on the overarching economic impacts at a regional level and the return on investment. The Great Lakes Commission is just kicking off a large-scale study that's going to try to give us that information. We're partnering with Council of Great Lakes Industries, the Great Lakes Metro Chambers Coalition, and a number of environmental organizations, working with some leading economists and using some pretty sophisticated economic models. Unfortunately, we don't have those numbers yet. We're hopeful to be able to come back in the fall and give you a stronger, more regional sense of what that economic impact has been. So stay tuned.
Like, there was a question here.
You said that the
corporate... Now, what's your name and office?
I am Frida Frosman. I am with Northeast Memphis. You said that corporations, they have keen interest in keeping Great Lakes restoration projects alive. Can you explain why? What is their interest?
Sure. I think there are two answers. One of them, the most pragmatic of the two, is cost share. That helps a great deal. But also, I think you saw from Matt and Chad some of the pictures of local businesses that have benefited from cleanups in, for example, areas of concern. I think there are many others, too, but local businesses in particular have benefited very directly from having more scenic places for their businesses, having areas that are more attractive to draw people and clients and customers back to. But those are a couple of things and trends that that we've seen. Thank you for the question.
Jared Mott, Isaac Walton Lee. A couple times Asian cars have come up. About 40% of efforts to kind of fight the part come out of GLRI. Can you talk a little about how some of that fund goes to research in turn? So when we're talking about the budget possibly, you know, being completely eliminated, and you compound that with whatever's happening with Brandon Road right now, what's sort of the picture? Like, what is in that 40%? What are we funding besides research? That we're looking at losing on top of whatever's happening in the core.
Part of that is subsidizing the state of Illinois to undertake overfishing in parts of the Illinois River to try and reduce the ongoing pressure upriver. So trying to remove as much of the fish population of Asian carp as we can to reduce the pressure for them to be pushed towards Lake Michigan. The state of Illinois, whose primary has that primary responsibility, would have no funds to undertake that work. And that kind of overfishing has actually been credited as helping to slow the ongoing progression of Asian carp towards Lake Michigan. So supporting statewide activities in the state of Illinois is one of those key things that would no longer be supported, in addition to supporting the research that's been primarily at U.S. Geologic Survey, which is looking at various technologies and others in the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, but also the Fish and Wildlife Service.
It's probably fair to say, and I can't confirm this without digging deep into the budget documents, but not only does the budget eliminate the GLRI, but there's pretty significant cuts to a lot of other agency budgets. And the GLRI really depends on a full suite of federal agencies to do the work. I mean, the money goes to EPA, but as Cam noted, majority of that money is passed through to the states or other federal agencies to do work where they have a unique capability or capacity to do that. So USGS with fishery research, Corps of Engineers with engineering and design on structures and techniques within waterways, Fish and Wildlife Service for fishery restoration, things of that nature. So, you know, the GLRI going away is bad, but it would be compounded by budget cuts to those other federal agencies that the GLRI depends on to get the work done. So that 40% of GLRI for Asian carp would go away. Of that 60%, likely some portion of that would likely go away as well. I can't quote a specific figure.
Well, and it's important to keep in mind that of the remaining money that comes out of the base budgets of the federal agencies, most of that is coming from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and most of that is just the operations of the electric barrier in the Chicago-Illinois waterway. Operating and maintaining that electric barrier is somewhere up to a $10 to $12 million per year expense just to keep the electricity running, to keep that barrier operational. So when you start adding up these annual costs and then you begin to cut the base budgets of these, you're really starting to make these agencies stretch thin, because they have to keep that electricity on all the time if we're going to be able to keep Asian carp from going into Lake Michigan. And so the budget cuts really put a strain on the ability of an organization like the Army Corps of Engineers in particular to be able to balance all of the various needs. It's not just, the Army Corps just doesn't do work in the Illinois River, they do work in all over the Great Lakes and nation for them. And so the budget cuts in the base level are compound the elimination of the GLRI.
Great, thank you.